Hour on Coast to Coast AM, an encore presentation from 1996. It's Art Bell and his first interview with Father Malachi Martin. And now, the very best of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
My guest is Dr. Malachi Martin. I'll tell you more about him in a moment, for those of you just joining. For many, many years, as a Catholic priest, he did exorcisms, real ones. He says there has been an 800% increase in recent years in exorcisms. That's in the northeast part of the country. He says our environmental problems, social problems, are catching up with us rapidly. He agrees, in substance, with what many of my other guests have said. This is not going to be easy to digest for you this morning. So, kind of set yourself up for it and get ready. And we'll get back to it in just a moment. Would you like to feel 10 years younger in 10 weeks? Now there's proof. The effects of aging can be slowed down and even reversed with HGH, human growth hormone. For some time now, you've heard me talk about the incredible age-reversing benefits of HGH. Well, according to thousands of articles, higher HGH levels can help you look and feel younger. That's why I take Ultimate HGH, a natural formula to help boost my body's own production of HGH. If your goal is to help improve energy, stamina, lose unwanted fat, diminish wrinkles, enhance memory, immune function, and vision, then Ultimate HGH is for you too. Why let Mother Nature get the best of you? Call today and order Ultimate HGH. And when you order two bottles of Ultimate HGH, you get the third absolutely free, about $33 a month. Now that's a tremendous savings off the typical $100 a month for comparable products. Plus, with your order, you'll receive a free book on HGH, a $20 value absolutely free. So call my good friends at Great American Products and order Ultimate HGH today at 1-800-557-4627. That's 1-800-557-4627. 1-800-557-4627. The best radio in the world. If you can afford it, you know, if you've got the money, then we have the best radio in the world. The CC Radio Plus, hands down, runaway, no contest, best radio in the world. $159.95, which is a cutesy way of saying $160. It's a lot of money for a radio. This is a lot of radio. It's like the last radio you'll have to buy. It's AM, and the AM reception is unparalleled. You will hear stations other radios don't even know exist. FM also, of course, superb. TV audio, weather radio, NOAA weather alert. The entire radio is designed to render human speech, particularly so that talk shows are come in with particular clarity, but, you know, it's so much more than that. It's got a digital clock built in with an alarm, a lighted dial, a sleep timer, simple one-button memory, very intuitive radio all the way down the line. Power cord is included, or if you want to use it on batteries, it'll go 250 hours on four D-cell batteries. To me, this is different, but the modern equivalent of the transoceanic. Remember that great old radio by Zenith? I mean, this thing is incredible. Absolutely incredible. So if you want the best, here's where you buy it. Sea Grain Company, call them in the morning at 6:30 a.m., 9:30 back east at 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863.
For your subscription to the After Dark newsletter, call now 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505.
Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Malachi Martin, for those of you who just joined. Malachi Martin, ex-Jesuit, former exorcist, one advisor to three popes, presently a best-selling author. As a premier investigator of clandestine politics, unlikely alliances of popes and cardinals, his novels offer rare insights into the men who guide nearly a billion people in faith and broker the destinies of countries and continents. As a member of the Vatican Intelligence Network under Pope John the 23rd, Martin helped extend the church into Iron Curtain countries. In 1964, concerned about the corrupting influences of power, Martin was released from his vows of poverty and obedience after 25 years as a Jesuit. He left Rome for New York, where he did odd jobs until a Guggenheim Fellowship enabled him to write his first bestseller, Hostage to the Devil. It was followed by the final conclave, Vatican. Three popes and the cardinal. The keys of this blood, the Jesuits, and many, many more. Born, by the way, in Kerry, Ireland in 1921. He has done many, many exorcisms, and that is generally what we're talking about right now. And possession, I'm trying to understand possession. And we left off last hour talking about the fact that it apparently is generational. Doctor, generational possession.
Yes. Let me explain that. It's not that possession is passed on with semen, passed on with genes. No. It's that the same demon inhabits the members of the same family for generations. Consentingly, consensually. He is nourished by them and kept by them and satisfied with them. The children are trained in it, and they perpetuate it in their children. It has gone on for generations. It's generational. And sometimes, unwillingly, we have cases in hand, for instance, of daughters to whom their mother attached her familiar, her evil spirit, and then we have the job of ridding them of that. And it takes time, and it's painful and anguishing.
How does a person know? I mean, is in the mind or the soul of the possessed?
Yes.
Is there always knowledge of that possession?
There is, but it can be limited knowledge, and can also be inhibited knowledge. Some of them can't even tell you about it. Some of them can. It depends on the particular type of demon. There are many types of demons. Some of them are quite intelligent. Some of them are very stupid. Most of them are specialized in one thing and one thing only, and that's all they can do. And it's a reflection of some gift as angels which they had, now distorted as demons. And in these matters, as in everything connected with it, go to the experts. Don't try and do it yourself.
Yes.
And then do not... A big confusion out which we should clear up for everybody, and it's this. There are many healers and deliverance experts, and many people will undergo lengthy prayers and incensings and various ceremonies. But the truth is this. The horrible truth is this. That if there is a demon in your life, and he dictates your behavior at least in one province of life, one area of life, he can only be expelled by direct confrontation, by somebody with authority to expel him. So when I say him, of course, spirits have no sex. They're not male or female. I just use him in the generic sense of the English word. But it's a confrontation. It's not a prayer. Gee whiz, if it was a prayer, it would be very simple to get rid of.
All right, this is something I want to ask about, yes. if I might for a moment, Doctor.
Sure.
I had a call a couple of weeks ago from a woman who yes. said that she had been in bed, believe this, with her children yes. one night, and she was attacked, Doctor, attacked by some sort of demon or spirit that was actually waiting upon her, actually trying to sodomize and
sure.
and rape her.
Sure.
And she was unable to speak, unable to move, unable to utter anything. And in the middle of this attack, the phone rang, the answering machine came on, somebody's voice began speaking, and whatever it was, left. Now, she said that the only way this thing would leave, and she had been attacked many times, mm-hmm. was if she audibilized some sort of something, and she said I sat there and I prayed and I asked God to cast off whatever this was,
yes.
and it would not go. And my question was, and I pondered after the call, it was a very serious, very scary call.
Yes.
And I pondered afterwards, if God hears our prayers, those cast silently forward,
yes,
then why would God not hear a silent plea, a scream, as it were? Why must something like this be audibilized?
There are mysteries about this entire situation to which we have no answer. But there are laws. He has set up laws governing the existence of man and woman, and one of them is that audibilizing something does make a difference. And it can be as simple as this, that the attention that a demon requires of the possessed person, or the person they're going to violate, can be that possession can be distracted. Their will can be diverted, their mind can be diverted from being, as it were, hypnotized, being held by some audible voice message from another normal human being. And God knows what grace of God that voice brings with them. But that it does happen, that audibilization does have an influence, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it.
And there's no specific answer as to
no specific answer. And you know, Art, there's the biggest problem is, who is possessible? People are always asking me, am I liable to be possessed? And we have tried to create a profile of the possessable person, but we have found that neither sex, nor education, nor color, nor race, nor education, nor riches, nor poverty. Nothing makes a difference. It's apparently, to our mind, it's random. Random choice. I know very naughty people,
yes,
who are not a bit possessed. They're just very,
very naughty
men and women. And then I know people who are not naughty at all, but lapse in one thing, and they do undergo possession.
Knowing the nature of humans,
yes,
if somebody has made, in effect, a pact with the devil,
yes, yes,
is it not more likely that those cases of possession would more frequently than not be the rich, the powerful, those who have attained great material success or wealth?
You would think so, Art, but
you would, yes,
de facto, no.
No.
Poor people, people with very little social resonance, people occupying very obscure positions in the social ladder, everybody is susceptible to some ambition, something they want, either for revenge or for self-satisfaction or for self-advancement,
yes,
and everybody is liable.
So the pact could be something as simple as the wanting or the wishing of a mate, or the attention of somebody of the opposite sex, or
that's right, to get married.
To get
to
married.
To get this man, to get this woman.
Yes.
You see, for instance, if I could do this, now I want to take the following example, but with great care. Do you remember Susan Smith?
Yes.
Drowned with two children?
Of course.
Now, for an exorcist, the pattern is very clear. The children were in her way.
Yes.
Of her ambition, whatever that ambition was, it concerned a young man.
Yes, it did.
And an exorcist could say about that, it was obvious that they were used as obstacles, they were used by Satan to possess her will and make her commit the grievous sin of matricide. Because she was convicted of that anyway, so I'm not accusing her of anything that she's not convicted of.
Of course not.
But that would be read by an exorcist as a typical example of possession of the will of somebody to commit a very evil act just for the sake of doing evil, because that's the whole point of the demon, to do evil for the sake of evil.
Should somebody like you have consulted with Susan Smith?
Well, if I was asked to. Generally, we people, we're very chary about intervening at all. And there's enough work on our plate to keep us going. But, yes.
Can somebody, doctor, of any faith be possessed?
Yes, of any faith. Doesn't matter. Of no faith at all.
Would a Catholic priest perform an exorcism on a non-Catholic?
Yes, he would. And we do. We do. Now, it's much more difficult because you can't call on their faith. Except faith, they generally emerge from an exorcism, a successful exorcism, with a tremendous faith in God. Not necessarily Catholic faith, but faith in God.
Speaking for the layman, There are many people walking around listening right now who are no doubt scared to death because at one time or another in their life, they have probably in a moment of despair or a moment of need said, I'd make a pact with the devil if I could just have so-and-so. And they're probably thinking at this moment, there's a pretty good chance they may be possessed.
You can't be possessed without knowing it. And you can't be possessed against your will. You may wish all day and all night for the devil to come and sign a pact with you, as it were, a Faustian thing, principle, like Mephistopheles in the play of Goethe. But it can't happen without your knowing it and without you willing it fully, finally fully, bit by bit by bit. So that you needn't be afraid that you're possessed and you don't know it. No, 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 that doesn't happen.
Well, are there not, though, no doubt, many people who have achieved success or achieved that goal for which they made that dark wish, that moment, and they certainly must wonder.
No, they know.
They know.
They know. They know. They know full well. And that's the darkest secret of their life.
The dark,
that,
indeed.
That sets them apart from wife or husband or lover or mistress or brother or sister.
And you say you have seen these people. You know these people when you see them.
Oh, yes, you do. You meet them in the street. You meet them in cocktail parties. You meet them at dinner parties. You meet them at meetings and conventions. And, of course, I must tell you that I get out of their way. I have enough of it. I don't want to confront them. I don't want to have anything to do with them. Unless I have to professionally.
Doctor, Catholic priests, how many Catholic priests are capable of or do within the church exorcisms?
Nowadays, Art, unfortunately, a minimum. As you know, in the last 25 or 30 years, belief in the devil, belief in evil incarnate, in an evil spirit, belief in hell, belief in the demons, the existence, and the activity, say, of Lucifer and of Satan. They're distinct demons, by the way. People often confuse them, but they're distinct demons. Belief in that has flagged, has got very weak. And the result is that when we started doing a lot of exorcisms here in the northeast corner of America in the 1970s, we finally had to go to Rome and ask permission because the local bishops, some of them didn't believe. So we went to Rome and said, look, these people, we need authority, because, by the way, nobody can do an exorcism without being given authority. And it must be a bishop gives authority. So we had to go and get special permission from Rome to do it, because we couldn't get it here. Now, some bishops do believe, some bishops don't believe, some priests do believe, some priests don't believe. Most of them want to have nothing to do with it. They know little and they want to know less. That really, and some bishops, some cardinals we know, say, look, don't bother me. You have all the authority you want, but don't tell me a thing about it. I don't want to have anything to do with it at all.
Possibly the source of the hear no evil, see no evil.
That's part of it. That's part of it. Because if you have to take into account that so-and-so, this political leader, this particular borough leader, this particular CEO is possessed, it does complicate life, Art. It does complicate life. If a big surgeon, a big psychiatrist, is by way of demonically possessed, it makes a huge difference.
Can a person of faith be possessed?
Can any person of faith be possessed?
Can a person of great faith be possessed?
No. No. Without the renouncing. The time comes when you're asked to make a change. You can't be possessed against your will. And if your will is strong in your faith, you can't be possessed. You can be obsessed. You can be bothered. You can be harassed.
Yes.
And harassed terribly. And the major portion of cases that occupy my daily dealing with this are cases of obsession and harassment. And they're terribly distressing.
What about the demographics of possession? We saw The Exorcist. Can a child be possessed?
No, except unless in exceptional cases you have children born and quickly developing at the age of 4, 5, with a will as strong as a person of 25, really.
Mm-hmm.
And they can undergo possession, but it's rare. It's very rare. They can be harassed and obsessed, and that usually generationally on account of the parents, on account of an aunt, on account of an uncle.
How, let's see, what's the right word? What word am I looking for? In a generational case of possession, does the parent actively actively teach this child in the dark way? Is it?
Oh yes. They assign the child to their demon. They're satisfied with that. The demon becomes what they call a familiar of theirs. And they give it a name. They call it Philip, they call it George, they call it John, they call it James, they call it Mary, whatever. And they assign the child to it, they teach the child to do obeisance to it. And they make the child participate in ceremonies, Satanist ceremonies.
Wow. There's a lot of that going on in America today?
A lot. It's very hard to say a lot. That it goes on continually and sustainedly in certain areas, yes. And whether it's Boston or whether it's Montana or California or New Mexico, the place doesn't matter. The place doesn't matter. There, I must confess to you that there is a lot of very impressive generational cases are found or have been found, not all, but a lot of such cases have been found amongst old American families.
The old traditional...
Yeah.
The old originally came over on the Mayflower kind of American families?
That sort of business, yes. It's a murky story and has never been written up properly, mainly because, well, it concerns family genealogies, you know, and it's hard to write that up and get it published, and then what's the point? But you come across generational possession and harassment, but possession too, in such families, such old families, whether they're Dutch Reformed or whether they're Puritan or whatever.
I suppose getting it in print, one reason might be the truth, Doctor. All right, I meant to ask you about an actual exorcism. When we come back, go ahead and relax. We will do that then.
Okay.
All right, Dr. Malachi Martin is my guest. A warning for you, it's probably going to get a little rough. We'll be right back.
Presentation of Coast to Coast AM is an encore presentation from 1996. It's Art Bell's very first interview with Father Malachi Martin. And now, the very best of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Dr. Malachi Martin is my guest. And we are about to ask him to describe the actual process of exorcism. He has done many, so I suspect he's capable of doing that. It's coming up shortly. Mars is coming. That's right, everybody. It's really coming. Mars is about to be, this coming summer, it's about to be closer to Earth than it's been in 50,000 years. Your view of Mars through a high-class deep space telescope is going to be the best view there's been in 50,000 years. This is not to be missed. And so we have for you this wonderful, big, classic telescope. This is the monster of them all, folks. Comes on a tripod with an equatorial mount. It's absolutely the best scope for the money. And deep space stargazing, planet hunting, and visiting real close up with Mars. What an opportunity. It's at forthenightsky.com. That's F-O-R, thenightsky.com. And aside from just that event worth seeing once in a lifetime, getting a telescope for you and your family will begin to change your outlook on a lot of things in life about who we are and where we are with reference to everything else that's out there. It's very educational as well as fun. The number, if you'd like to order for Christmas, is 1-800-394-3307 at forthenightsky.com on the web. That's F-O-R, thenightsky.com on the web. Or 1-800-394-3307. Back now to Dr. Malachi Martin, and Doctor, you're in, I haven't even told everybody, you're in Manhattan, aren't you?
That's right. I live in Manhattan, upper Manhattan.
Doctor, as a young priest, how did you first, what was your first exorcism, and what was your reaction to it?
Well, my first exorcism was in Cairo, Egypt, and I was a young priest, and I was an archaeologist. I was lying on my belly or my back in caves. On the Sinai Peninsula, copying inscriptions dating from about the time of Abraham, about 1600 or 1700 B.C. That's about, 3,000 years ago, more than 3,000
years ago. Long time ago, yes.
And an exorcism was going on, and I didn't know it. When I came back down by plane and checked into Cairo, because I came down every couple of weeks to get a bath and to eat properly.
Yes.
Because we lived on goat's cheese and black coffee when we were up digging. One of the priests was telling me that he was engaged in an exorcism and his assistant has collapsed, which is not uncommon with young assistants, because in your first exorcism, if you've never done it before, the impact is so great, sometimes you become totally incontinent. It scares you.
To the point where you can't move and can't speak and can't help.
And everything, all the portals are loosened. You have diarrhea. You vomit. Because it's so repellent. It's so shocking.
So it's not for the weak of heart.
No, it's not. And I'll describe in a moment exactly what is the repellent part about it.
All right.
So I was asked to assist, so I did. And apparently I had a very strong constitution, still have. And I hadn't got that effect. It had a disgusting effect. It always has. That was the first time. It was a very sticky exorcism. In general, if you want to understand what an exorcism is like and what's really the essence of the difficulty, the horror, you must imagine, say, a common scene. It's a room. It's always within a room, within a house. It's in a room. There's none of the walls, no nails, no pictures, nothing that can move. If the windows are there, they're barred with shutters. You don't have glass around the place that can be shattered.
All of this is prepared.
All this is prepared. And we have the person in question is either violent or not. Most times not violent to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And there's either a bed, an iron bed, or a chair, or whatever. There's you have no table, but you have an exorcist with an assistant, and he has assistants there. The assistant is a priest, and then he has several other people, usually men, dressed in clothes that can take a lot of hardware. And they carry everything in their hands. They have to have a candle, and they have to have holy water, and they have to have the priest's a prayer book, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the point. I said before that people undergo a psychiatric examination, undergo a medical examination, and finally people say, okay, let's try exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that within the first 20 minutes, you know if it's a real case of possession, and then you're into it, and you can't withdraw. Okay, boys, let's break up and see each other next Monday. You can't do that. Once you start it, you've got to finish it.
Or else what? Why?
Or else you are pursued by that demon.
You are pursued. The yes. Exorcist.
That's right. And everybody in that room has troubles. And the troubles can be extraordinary. I mean, I've seen assistants trying to hold somebody down and dropping the person and looking at each other, because the person, the possessed person, will start telling the telling one man what the other man did to his wife.
Oh boy.
Oh, yes, yes, we've been through that too. And sometimes it's a lie, sometimes it's true, sometimes it's an exaggeration. Anyway, but after the first 20 minutes, what happens? In that 20 minutes, the following happens. Now, the temperature of the room may change, there may be a horrible smell, there may not be a horrible smell, all those are incidental things. The olfactory experience or the heat and the cold experience. But here's the real point. At a certain moment, if it's really an exorcism, mm-hmm. and if we are in the presence of a possessing spirit or a threatening spirit, demon, everybody in the room, the priest and his assistant and the assistants, they know, and I can only call on some experiences of people listening to me, and you yourself, Art, you know there's something in the room that wants you dead. But dead. I mean, I've only been twice in my life threatened with real death, but really threatened. Once was in Czechoslovakia, and once was in America. And it's a horrible feeling knowing that unless something happens, you are going to die. Now.
Yes.
And that's the it's like an invisible animal, it claws, and it wants you dead. It really wants your life's blood. It wants you extinguished.
Has it happened, Doctor? Has an assistant or an exorcist or anybody present at an exorcism ever been killed?
Well, no, but they have died of heart attack. They've died of some form of internal health attack. None of them have been killed, exactly, except in one case. I wasn't present at it. There was a case in America where the person was flung out a window and defenestrated and killed 8 stories down.
Well, out a window or a heart attack, it's dead.
Yeah, it's dead. But the point is that the experience is everybody in the room suddenly knows. You don't even look at each other, you know. Especially if you've done exorcism before with the same team. You know, this is it. We're now in that presence. It's and the point is this. Here's the point I want to drive home. It's a confrontation, not a series of prayers, of pious wishes, and of deliverance and healing invocations. No, no, no. This is a confrontation between the exorcist's will and the possessing demon or the harassing demon. And thereby, then, there comes the conversation. Because the exorcist has to find out the name, what the demon calls himself, if we want to speak about himself. It's not himself or herself, as we all know. But anyway, what their name is. And the name is usually a reflection of their function, what their function is as an evil spirit. And you have to get them to admit that. There are certain rules. You never answer a question put to you by the possessed person. You always fling a question back at them.
How do you know when you are speaking with that demon?
It is impossible not to know it once the person starts talking. It is impossible not to know. You know. Everybody in the room knows. And it's not a change of voice. Sometimes the voice is a big change of the voice. Sometimes it's a small change. But there's something, the manifestation of the spirit, when it's cornered by an authorized exorcist, is palpably clear, like the nose in your face. Everybody knows. And there's no deception about it, and it has this bone-chilling effect.
So it's like a war.
It's a war.
Once it begins.
It's a real confrontation, and this is where people make a mistake about treating with evil spirits. If they think or suspect or know that they're being bothered, they attempt to take it on themselves, and you can't do it. You have no authority.
I was going to say, this is one of those don't try it at home things. In other words,
that's right.
You don't sit by a bed and attempt yourself, not knowing what you're doing,
no,
to say a nice little prayer that this spirit will leave the body.
You can do that if you want to, and it's okay to do it, and it does relieve the pressure and the tension, blah, 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 blah. But it does not. It does not dispossess a possessing spirit. It does not. For that, you need authority. And this is the difficulty that Buddhists and Jews and non-Catholics sometimes come to us and say, we've been trying exorcism and it doesn't work. And one would laugh if it weren't so pathetic at times. Because they must have it's only the authority of Christ can get rid of the spirit. And that's what takes place. Therefore, and then that can be long or short. It can be a long game of cat and mouse trying to trap the demon, trying to get it to conceal. And then it lapses into complete silence or violence.
Doctor, we hear of successes at the end. The story usually ends well. Are there failures? Are there times
there when... are failures where it's total failure. And that is calamitous, because then that means the person goes ahead possessed. It means that the exorcist has sacrificed something for nothing. Because let me explain something to your art, which is very hard to explain, but there are parallels, analogies in life that helps. When you do exorcism, you give something which you can't get back. It's like, for instance, any parent who has reared children will tell you, oh, I gave them so much love.
Yes.
And they're not talking about money or food. But they're thinking about what they gave of themselves. You give of yourself in love and affection and devotion and planning, etc., etc.
And
you
war.
Can't get it back. And no parent wants it back, really. Similarly with an exorcism, the exorcist gives, a little part of him dies, put it like that, and goes away and waits for him in heaven.
Little slice of death.
Yes, a little slice. And, for instance, after a bad exorcism, I mean a long, unhealthy one, you don't eat very much for a couple of weeks, and you don't sleep very deeply either. You can't. You can't. You've been locked in combat with a very, very insalubrious, unhealthy, anti-human, heating spirit that has communicated with you.
For those not of faith, are there, during the course of exorcisms, actual physical manifestations in or near the person or around the person or in the room, as in the movie? Do things ever move? Do you actually...
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, things move. If there's anything movable in the room, it's going to move. If there are nails on the wall, if there are pictures, if there are windows that can be broken, they'll be probably be broken. If there's something which is weak, unbreakable, it can break. It can move. So you want to have a very bare situation completely. And even then, the exorcist is not free once it's all over. I've been flung out of bed. I've been knocked off stools and broken my shoulder by the demon. Get his own back just to remind me he was there and to make me pay a price for the damage I did.
This is like going to war. It's very much like going to
war.
It's
a war. What most people don't realize is that there's a spiritual war on, and as St. Paul says, it's a war with the spirits. It's a war with the forces of evil, the invisible forces that want men's souls.
Are there times as a priest
mm-hmm.
where even the very best of men, doctor, sometimes fear war reasonably. Does a priest sometimes fear entering this war when you
yes.
when you know you are about to
yes.
meet up once again with
yes.
the worst?
Yes, there's always that fear. And a very old exorcist gave me advice years ago in Ireland. I mentioned this to him, and he said, okay, but listen, learn to measure your love of God by the amount of fear in your heart.
Hmm.
Which is a very profound statement.
It is, yes.
Because it depends on how much you love God. And if you really love Him as Father, as Savior, and as final end of everything, and as the beautifier, and as the creator of nature, the creator of all beauty in our lives, it can expel fear. But if you nourish fear, fear can grow, and not quantitatively, but it can equal or surpass the amount of love you have in your heart. And then you're in danger, because that fear is going to make you despair. That fear is going to make you timorous. That fear is going to make you vulnerable.
Vulnerable.
Love is the only thing that can cure it. Love is the only protection we have.
You mentioned there were priests who do not believe that people
That's right.
are possessed.
That's right.
Um, do they carry that belief because of fear, do you think, for the most part, or?
No, Art, the cases I have known are priests whose faith has been diminished. See, faith is not a quantum, like a bank balance or something in your pocket.
Yes.
Or clothes you wear. It's a dimension of soul. And that dimension can be greater or less, greater or lesser. And it can be diminished by infidelities, by sin, by fecklessness, by carelessness. It can be increased by virtue. It can be increased by good actions. It can be increased by the grace of God. But it's usually because of the lack of faith. When they think that there's no such thing as evil, really, that it's okay, do what you like, just don't frighten the horses. But there are laws, though. God has laws, and he doesn't allow them to violate it. You can violate them, but you're going to pay the price. And one of the prices is that you slowly but surely edge towards that region of human existence where the demons are dominant. And they will satisfy you. They'll give you a good life. But you end up their prisoner. Their prisoner.
Is there ever a case where the person who is possessed dies in the course of the exorcism?
Yes, it has happened. And it's caused untold trouble because there's usually a lawsuit. But that's why we are very careful as regards the medical condition of the persons that we exorcise.
You say there's a lawsuit.
The husband or the wife or the boy or the friend or the son or the daughter sue the priest.
Sue the priest?
Yeah. For having put their relative through an experience that caused them to have a heart attack. Caused them to have a coronary, whatever. It has happened.
What would happen, doctor, to the soul of the person who would die under such circumstances?
Under their circumstances, we must say we don't know. There's always the chance. You know the old story between the bridge and the water? This man was pursued by his enemies and living in sin, and he tried to jump over a bridge and swim into the water, but they shot him.
Yes.
But before his body hit the water, he had repented. There's always this. You never know. You just never know. I just wouldn't like to be in that position myself.
Has that happened to you?
Yes, it has happened to me. It has happened to me. And it's very distressing. And then I've been asked to go to see people who are possessed by their husband or their wife or their brother or their sister and come away empty-handed. They simply told me to go to hell. Literally.
Well, that would be one pretty good sign, wouldn't it? I mean, it's just not something you do is tell a priest to go to hell.
It's very discouraging. Very discouraging, and they do it with great hate. Great hate.
Well, as I say, wouldn't that be a very clear sign?
It is. It is, Art.
And so if you are told to go to hell, to get out of here, I don't want anything to do with you, which I can imagine, more than not, you might be told, then what do you do?
Well, yeah, you go away and you pray. But, you see, for instance, if I go into the greengrocer and I find the milk he's supplying me is rotten, and I say, listen, this milk is smells highly, he says, listen, buddy, get the hell out of here. That's one way. That merely means stop bothering me. But if somebody tells you in the way that it does happen now and again to an exorcist, please go to hell. Because that's where I'm going. I want to be with the prince. And I'm quoting a certain case to you. Then it chills your bones. Because you know you're up against somebody perfectly possessed who just is waiting to die and go home to his master.
Have you ever wondered, doctor, about your own heart, about your own constitution going into one of these?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. And my heart specialist has always warned me that there's a danger there. And I know there is. There is. But, you see, when you're over 70, you know, the amount of good you can do in this world is limited because you're no longer 20, 25, 30. And therefore, whatever good you can do, you do if you're wise. Because one day soon, I'm going to take the high jump.
As we all shall.
As we all shall.
So, even today, if you encountered it, you would still do it?
Oh, yes, I would. Oh, yes, I would. Because the commiseration, the human compassion, and the pity that the Holy Spirit puts in your heart impels you, because they are miserable. And they make appeals to you, unless they're completely possessed.
Doctor, hold tight, relax,
sure.
And I can use a moment of relaxation as well, and we'll be right back to you. My guest is Dr. Malachi Martin. This is CBC.